Next week, part two. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. In the documentary we just heard, Steve Wilson and Jane Acree, two former Fox television news reporters, spoke about their attempts to bring out the truth on Monsanto's bovine growth hormone after refusing orders from their employers to lie about what they had found. They were fired. Paul Richmondel of Media Geek spoke with Wilson and Acree about their current challenge to Fox's broadcast license.
Steve Wilson
and Jane Acree.
The both of you are challenging the license of a Fox television station in Tampa, Florida, WTVT. Can you tell me why you're doing that?
Well, we're doing it because our experience there has led us to conclude that they're not operating the station in the public interest. Specifically, as investigative reporters, we were pressured by the management of the television station to broadcast what we knew and well documented to be false and distorted news reports. The station had been pressured by someone who had been threatening to sue and by advertisers who had been threatening to drop advertising, and in response they wanted to not just soften a story and not sweep it under the rug, but put it on the air with information that would not offend the advertisers and the potential litigant, but seriously mislead and we maintain lie to the viewers.
Now, this is something, though, you don't hear of too often, people challenging the licenses of television stations for any reason, but especially for their conduct in journalism.
You do hear about challenging licenses, and they're all on an eight-year program, so you're hearing a lot about it now because they're all coming up for renewal, mm-hmm. but you're hearing about it more in the case of indecency. This is the first time in a long time that it's been challenged for distorting the news. I think the last time that this sort of a petition was filed was in 1975 in a case called Serafin, who charged that CBS was distorting the news in a report on 60 Minutes.
And how did that challenge go?
The FCC rejected it,
mm-hmm.
and they appealed, and the appellate court ordered the FCC to go back and reexamine the issues. So it went farther than any case ever had. But ultimately, the FCC decided that there was no news distortion.
The FCC response was indicative of the question that you raise, and that is you don't see many of these, and you don't see many because the FCC had gotten itself into a situation where, as with so many other issues, it just dismissed such complaints out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the significance of the Serafin complaint, which involved, as Jane said, a 60 Minutes broadcast, was that when the FCC did dismiss it virtually out of hand, the higher court said, hey, wait a minute, your job is to review this stuff, go back and review it. At that point, before a review could be completed, 60 Minutes reached a settlement with the complainant, and the whole thing became moot. But essentially it opened the door, and it said to the FCC, you can't just brush this stuff off, this is why you exist.
So specifically in your case, you both worked for WTVT and worked on an investigative story, which, as you just alluded to before, your management did not want to air as you had were intending to report it. Can you give us more background on that case?
Yes, we had produced a four-part series, and it went through initial review, and that means the lawyers looked at it and they signed off on it. So much so to the point that the station was putting on the air promos for, you know, the viewing public to make sure they tuned in Monday at 6 o'clock to see the series. After the Monsanto letters arrived, and by the way, people can see them on the website that we have, which is foxbghsuit.com.
And so this report was on bovine growth hormone.
Yes, it is, Monsanto's product. And the Monsanto sent two very strongly worded letters a week apart. That said, essentially, cease and desist, your reporters are idiots and their sources are incompetent. And the second letter from Monsanto said that there will be dire consequences if the story airs in Florida, which is, you know, not a veiled threat to sue. And after that, all of a sudden, the story that had been approved for air now all of a sudden was unapproved for air. And we went back into a re-editing session that lasted 8 months, and during which time they wanted to take out the sum and substance of what we had found, let the Monsanto point of view stand unrefuted. And it was just amazing. Every single slice and jab they made at that piece was intended to weaken it, and we contended to falsify it. I mean, unfortunately, a broadcaster can weaken a story, and they can even choose not to do a story, but they can't cross the line and tell you to say something that is not true. And that's where we contend and went to trial on the basis that they were pressuring us to lie on the air.
And what was the result of that trial?
It took several years to get to trial, but we were basically separate plaintiffs, and the jury found that I had proven that I was terminated because I threatened to disclose to the Federal Communications Commission the broadcast of a false, distorted, or slanted news report, which I believed would violate the prohibition against intentionally falsifying the news. The jury did not find in favor of Steve, but they found in favor of me, which is kind of a strange thing because it was the same case. But we think it's because Steve was representing himself in court. But the point we were making was that we were retaliated against for resisting a story that had been falsified, and the jury agreed with at least me on that count. So what later happened was Fox immediately filed an appeal on the basis that there's technically no law, rule, or regulation against news distortion. Therefore, it's not a whistleblower violation, which is kind of a shocking allegation or a claim for a news organization to
make.
But nonetheless, they did.
They have to almost admit that they were distorting or lying in order to say that.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And they did do that. That's exactly the words they used. And the appellate panel of three judges eventually agreed with them.
Agreed with Fox. Okay. Wow. And so what is the specific falsity? What was it that Fox wanted to report or did report that you believe is false?
Well, a number of things. I mean, it went on for 8 months, so it just went back and forth and back and forth. But, I mean, for example, they said take out all references to cancer. And that's more of a sin of omission, I suppose. They said, go ahead and repeat the Monsanto claim that this is the same wholesome product that it's always been, the milk, that is from treated cows. And, you know, we had a problem with that because our research and Monsanto's own research shows that the milk from cows treated with artificial bovine growth hormone have a higher amount of a spinoff hormone called IGF-1. And that ends up in the milk, and that is consumed by people who are consuming treated milk. And they said, say the milk is the same wholesome product. And, you know, we said, you can't say that because it's not true. And, you know, here's the documentation, you know, study after study, Monsanto's own study. Well, they didn't want to hear that. They said, don't say that Europe is concerned and has banned the drug based on human health concerns. And we said, well, here's something from Parliament that says that's exactly why they're concerned about it. Don't say that. Call it economic concerns. It just went on and on and back and forth like that for a very long time. And basically, they wanted to not only gut the story, but as I said, make it false and distorted.
And how common is it in investigative television journalism that there is this kind of pushback from companies, corporations, organizations which are going to have some of their secrets revealed?
I think it happens every day. We don't hear about it, but it happens all the time. You know, one of the turning points, I think, was when you might recall years ago when ABC News went into Food Lion and did an investigation about some of the shoddy and unsafe health practices that were going on in the meat counter, and they caught it. They caught it on camera, and it's stuff that would just make your stomach turn. Yet, when Food Lion sued, they won. They won based on some obscure law that if you're an employee, you can't go in and misstate what your purpose is in being an employee. Some sort of a employment law like that. But nonetheless, it gave not only Food Lion but other corporations that want to challenge news, it gave them added resolve that they could go ahead and, you know, even in the face of unrefutable evidence, go ahead and win a case.
Mm-hmm. And so, so in your experience in television journalism, had you seen these sorts of lawyer-written letters filed before?
Yes.
And did they typically have a strong effect, or did more often management decide to go forward with stories?
You know, a good news organization expects them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have reviewed the material that the reporters handed in, if they look at the documentation, if they trust their reporter, they send back a standard letter, a template letter saying, thank you very much for your concerns, we're looking into it, da-da-da-da. You know, we want to assure you that we have the highest standards of broadcast journalism and will not air anything that we know to be untrue.
Oh, again, this issue of falsity and truth, isn't it? Only this time they're assuring it to the corporate party who is complaining.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, what's so significant in our case, I think, is the fact that I've been in this business for more than 30 years, and it's not unheard of for a television station, even a network, to sweep a story under the rug when it's something that, you know, affects their own personal interest or their corporate interest, and the story just doesn't get told. I mean, that's kind of an open secret in the business. That's why you don't see investigations of certain issues. That's why you won't see, for instance, NBC investigating itself or its parent company, General Electric, and how it might be polluting the Hudson River. They don't devote a lot of time and resources to that, and that's reprehensible in the sense that, you know, they're there to serve the public interest, and they're making millions and millions of dollars off that broadcast license. They ought to put the public interest first. But what was so egregious in this case, and what was so unusual in this case, is that it's the first time that I've ever known that a reporter has been asked to deliberately lie, that a television station or news organization has said, no, we're not going to sweep it under the rug. And in our case, they decided not to do what they said because they were afraid we'd tell people. I mean, the first thing we were asked was, you know, what would you do if we kill the story? Would you tell anybody? And instead of sweeping it under the rug and taking the hit for covering it up, they decided they'd simply pressure us into broadcasting a story that wasn't true but would keep the advertisers and the litigants happy.
And so you're contending that in airing what you believe, and then actually you found a jury to believe, is false information, is an example of the station not acting in the public interest, which is something which they're required to do under the statutes of the Telecommunications Act.
Absolutely. They have a license to run their business. You know, it's not like going out and starting up a newspaper. You know, you could go down to Kinko's, I suppose, and Xerox 100 copies of your own newspaper and pass it out for free or for fee. It wouldn't matter. Anybody can have a newspaper. But not everybody in town can operate a television station because there is a very limited resource there. And it's a public resource. It's like when logging companies go into our national forest and cut down trees that are owned by the citizens, or when farmers graze their cattle on federal land. These are public resources, and in exchange for having the license to be one of the few who can actually use the public resource of a television station, they must operate the station in the public interest. It is not in the public interest to lie to people.
And have you received any feedback, either from the station or from other interested parties, on your challenge?
Well, the way it works is you file your petition to deny, and then the station has 30 days to respond, and the 30-day deadline will be coming up here around the 3rd or 4th of February, I think it is. So we have not seen the station's formal response. Of course, in the papers, they said we would never do such a thing. We don't operate our station that way. We have the highest standards of good journalism, which, you know, is pretty much what you'd expect to hear. But, you know, in this case, there's a record. In this case, the people who are making the complaints are not people who just watch television and think they're getting a distorted view. We were insiders. We were there. We have the documents. We have the memos. We have the scripts. We have all of that which the commission ought to rely upon to determine whether or not the charges and the claims is true. And, you know, that's what we're hoping they will do, that they won't simply just brush it off. And let me also say that, you know, there are no bigger supporters of the First Amendment than we are. I mean, you know, the defense to which many people jump is, oh, geez, do you want the government being the news editor? No, I don't want the government being the news editor, and I value the First Amendment as all journalists and all citizens do or should. But, you know, the First Amendment is not a license to lie. The First Amendment is not so all-embracing that you can take a television station, you can use the public airwaves, and you can deliberately lie to people and say, well, that's my First Amendment right to do so. That's the argument that Fox is making. That's how they got the jury verdict overturned. The court never found that the jury was wrong when they concluded that the story we were pressured to broadcast was false, distorted, or slanted. That didn't happen. What happened was that the appellate court, on what they call a threshold issue, bought the Fox argument that it's not illegal to lie on television. There is no law, rule, or regulation that makes it against the law for them to deliberately lie. And therefore, if it wasn't a violation of a law that we were complaining about, we should never have received protection as whistleblowers in the first place, and therefore the jury verdict is overturned. Well, you know, I don't know what would make me more ashamed, working for a company that deliberately distorts the news, or working for one that then goes out and argues, well, it's not illegal to lie, and even though we would never lie, and we didn't lie this time, despite what the jury found, technically it's not against the law because the First Amendment covers us. That's despicable.
And if there are people listening who are moved by what you're saying, how can they learn more or perhaps even lend a hand?
Well, as Jane said, we have a website, all the information. We try to keep it updated. We're in desperate need of a webmaster. I think we've worn ours out. All of the information and the access to the petition to deny and the access to everything that has transpired is there. It's www.foxbghsuit. BGH is in bovine growth hormone. Suit is in lawsuit. Foxbghsuit.com.
And the interviewer was Paul Riesmandel of Media Geek. We'll conclude with something fun but piercing.
My name is Scooter. You're listening to The Inner Side, produced at KPFT Houston, for Free Radio Santa Cruz, LPFM, and community radio stations worldwide. This program is the first in a series focusing on Mark Twain, specifically Letters from the Earth, posthumously published in 1962 from a manuscript written in 1909. In regard to this manuscript, Mark Twain wrote himself, quote, "This book will never be published. In fact, it couldn't be, because it would be a felony," unquote. In 1938, Bernard DeVoto became literary editor of Twain's estate. He decided to publish unused manuscripts that he deemed worthy of the public's attention. In 1939, he presented a manuscript of over 20 writings to the estate's trustees, seeking approval for publication. Clara Clemens, Twain's daughter, objected to the publication of the manuscript, feeling that it misrepresented her father's beliefs about religion. As a result, publication of the book was delayed until 1962, when Clara died. The serious-minded aspects of the now-published book presented Twain in a new light for many 20th century readers, the Twain you didn't learn about in junior high. Letters from Earth spent 18 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list upon its release in 1962. About letters, the New York Times wrote, quote, "The attitude is that of Swift, the intellectual contempt is that of Voltaire, and the imagination is that of one of the great masters of American writing," unquote. Letters from the Earth by Mark Twain. The Creator sat upon his throne, thinking. At his feet stood three colossal figures. Archangels. their heads level with his ankle bone. Behind him stretched the illimitable continent of heaven, steeped in a glory of light and color. Before him rose the black night of space, like a wall. His mighty bulk towered rugged and mountain-like into the zenith, and his divine head blazed there like a distant sun. When the Creator had finished thinking, he said,
"I have thought. Behold!"
He lifted his hand, and from it burst a fountain spray of fire. A million stupendous blazing suns and giant stars which clove the blackness and soared away and away, illuminating the endless depths of infinity. Diminishing in magnitude and intensity as they pierced the far frontiers of space. Until at last they were but as diamond nailheads sparkling under the dome vast roof of the universe. At the end of an hour, the Grand Council was dismissed. They left the presence, impressed and thoughtful, and retired to a private place where they might talk with freedom. None of the three seemed to want to begin, though all wanted someone to do it. Each was burning to discuss the great event, but would prefer not to commit himself until he should know how the others regarded it. So there was some aimless and halting conversation about matters of no consequence, and this dragged tediously along, arriving nowhere, until at last the archangel, Satan, gathered his courage together, of which he had a very good supply, and broke ground. He said, "We know what we're here to talk about, my lords, and we may as well put pretense aside and begin, if this is the opinion of the council." It is," said Gabriel and Michael, gratefully interrupting. "Very well, then, let us proceed. We have witnessed a wonderful thing. As to that, we are necessarily agreed. As to the value of it, if it has any, that is a matter which does not personally concern us. We can have as many opinions as we like, and that's our limit. We have no vote. I think space was well enough just as it was, and useful. Cold, dark, a restful place now and then after a season of the over-delicate climate and trying splendors of heaven. But these are details of no considerable moment. The new feature, the immense feature, is what, gentlemen? The invention and introduction of automatic, unsupervised, self-regulating law for the government of those myriads of whirling and racing suns and worlds? That is it," said Satan. "It is a stupendous idea. Nothing approaching it has evolved from the master intellect before. Law, automatic law, exact and unvarying law, requiring no watching, no correcting, no readjusting while the eternities endure." He said those countless vast bodies would plunge through the waste of space, ages and ages at unimaginable speed, around stupendous orbit, yet never collide. This is the new miracle. And the greatest of all, automatic law. And he gave it a name, the law of nature, and said natural law is the law of God. Interchangeable names for the same thing. "Yes," said Michael. He said he would establish natural law, the law of God through his dominions, and its authority should be supreme and inviolable. Yeah, and also, said Gabriel, he said he would by and by create animals and place them likewise under the authority of that law. Well, yeah, said Satan, I heard him, but did not understand. What is animals, Gabriel? How should I know? How should any of us know? It is a new word. Time passes, an interval of 3 centuries celestial time, the equivalent of 100 million years earthly time. Enter a messenger angel.
My lords, he's making animals. Will it please you to come and see?
They went, they saw, and were perplexed, deeply perplexed. And the creator noticed it and said,
Ask, I will answer.
Divine one, said Satan, making obeisance, what are they for?
They are an experiment in morals and conduct. Observe them and be instructed.
There were thousands of them, and they were full of activities, busy, all busy, mainly in persecuting each other. Satan remarked after examining one of them through a powerful microscope, This large beast is killing weaker animals, Divine One.
The tiger, yes, the law of nature is ferocity. The law of nature is the law of God. He cannot disobey it.
Then in obeying it, he commits no offense, Divine One?
No, he is blameless.
This other creature here is timid, Divine One, and suffers death without resisting.
The rabbit, yes. He is without courage. It is the law of his nature, the law of God. He must obey it.
Then he cannot honorably be required to go counter to his nature and resist, Divine One.
No creature can honorably be required to go counter to the law of his nature, the law of God.
After a long time and many questions, Satan said, So the spider kills the fly and eats it. The bird kills the spider and eats it. The wild cat kills the goose. They all kill each other. It's murder all along the line. Here are countless multitudes of creature, and they all kill, kill, kill. They're all murderers, and they are not to blame, Divine One?
They are not to blame. It is the law of their nature, and always the law of nature is the law of God. Now observe. Behold, a new creature and the masterpiece. Man.
Men, women, and children, they came swarming in flocks, in droves, in millions. What shall ye do with them, Divine One?
I shall put into each individual, in differing shades and degrees, all the various moral qualities in mass that have been distributed, a single distinguishing characteristic at a time, among the non-speaking animal world. Courage, cowardice, ferocity, gentleness, fairness, justice, cunning, treachery, magnanimity, cruelty, malice, malignancy, lust, mercy, pity, purity, selfishness, sweetness, honor, love, hate, baseness, nobility, loyalty, falsity, veracity, untruthfulness. Each human being shall have all of these in him, and they will constitute his nature. In some, there will be high and fine characteristics, which will submerge the evil ones, and those will be called good men. In others, the evil characteristics will have dominion, and those will be called bad men. Observe. Behold, they vanish.
Whither are they gone, Divine One?
To the earth, they and all their fellow animals.
And what is the earth?
A small globe I made, time, 2.5 ago. You saw it, but did not notice it in the explosion of worlds and suns that sprayed from my hand. Man is an experiment, and other animals are another experiment. Time will show whether they are worth the trouble. The exhibition is over. You may take your leave, my lords.
Several days passed. This stands for a long stretch of our time, since in heaven, a day is 1,000 years. Satan had been making admiring remarks about certain of the creature's sparkling industries, remarks which, being read between the lines, were sarcasms. He had made them in confidence to his safe friends, the other archangels, but they had been overheard by some ordinary angels and reported to headquarters. Satan was ordered into banishment for a day, the celestial day. It was a punishment he was used to on account of his too flexible tongue. Formerly, he had been deported into space, there being nowhere else to send him, and had flapped tediously around there in the eternal night and the Arctic chill. But now it occurred to him to push on and hunt up the Earth and see how the human race experiment was coming. It was winter, 1590. Eseldorf, Austria was far away from the world and asleep. It was the Middle Ages and promised to remain so forever. Some said it was still the age of belief in Austria, and they meant it as a compliment, not a slur. And we were all proud of it. I remember it well, although I was only a boy. Yes, Austria was far from the world and asleep, and our village was in the middle of that sleep, being in the middle of Austria. It drowsed in peace in the deep privacy of a hilly and woodsy solitude where news from the world hardly ever came to disturb its dreams. At its front flowed the tranquil river. Behind it rose the woody steeps to the base of the lofty precipice. From the top of the precipice frowned a vast castle, its long stretch of towers and bastions mailed in vines. Beyond the river lay a far-reaching plain dotted with little homesteads nested among orchards and shade trees. The whole region, for leagues around, was the hereditary property of a prince, whose servants kept the castle always in perfect condition for occupancy. But neither he nor his family came there more often than once in 5 years. When they came, it was as if the Lord of the world had arrived and had brought all the glories of its kingdoms alone. And when they went, they left a calm behind, which was like the deep sleep following an orgy. Eseldorf was a paradise for us boys. We were not overly pestered with schooling. Mainly we were trained to be good Christians, to revere the Virgin, the Church, and the saints above everything. Beyond these matters, we were not required to know much, and in fact, not allowed to. Knowledge was not good for the common people and could make them discontented with the lot which God had appointed for them. And God did not endure discontent with his plans. We had two priests. One of them, Father Adolf, was a very zealous and strenuous priest. There have been better priests than Father Adolf, but there was never one in our commune held in more solemn and awful respect. This was because he had absolutely no fear of the devil. He was the only Christian I've ever known of whom that could be said. People stood in deep dread of him on that account, for they thought there must be something supernatural about him, else he could not be so bold and confident. All men speak in bitter disapproval of the devil, but they do it reverently, not flippantly. But Father Adolf was very different. He called him by every name he could lay his tongue to, and it made everyone shudder that heard him. Often he would even speak of them scornfully and scoffingly. Then the people crossed themselves and went quickly out of his presence, fearing that something awful would happen. Father Adolf had actually met Satan face to face more than once and defied him. This was known to be so. Father Adolf said it himself. And he was speaking true. There was proof in at least one instance. For on that occasion he quarreled with the demon and intrepidly threw his bottle at him. And there, upon the wall of his study, was the ruddy splotch where it struck and broke. But it was Father Peter, the other priest, that we loved best and were sorriest for. Some people charged him with talking around in conversation. God was all goodness and would find a way to save all his poor human children. It was a horrible thing to say, but there never was any absolute proof that Father Peter had said it. And it was out of character for him, for he was always good and gentle and truthful. He wasn't charged with saying it in the pulpit, where all the congregation could hear and testify, but only outside, in talk, and it is easy for enemies to manufacture that. Father Peter had an enemy, and a very powerful one, the astrologer who lived in a tumbled old tower up the valley, and put in his nights studying the stars. Everyone knew he could foretell wars and famines, though that was not so hard, for there was always a war, and generally a famine somewhere. Everyone in the village except Father Peter stood in awe of him. Even Father Adolf, who had defied the devil, had a wholesome respect for the astrologer. The bishop himself even listened to the astrologer, who made a great show of piety, which would always impress the bishop, of course. But Father Peter took no stock in the astrologer. He denounced him openly as a charlatan, a fraud with no valuable knowledge of any kind, or powers beyond those of an ordinary and rather inferior human being, which naturally made the astrologer hate Father Peter and wish to ruin him. It was the astrologer, as we all believed, who originated the story about Father Peter's shocking remark and carried it to the bishop, who suspended Father Peter indefinitely, though he wouldn't go so far as to excommunicate him on the evidence of only one witness. And now Father Peter had been out a couple of years, and our other priest, Father Adolf, had his flock. Those had been hard years for the old priest and his daughter, Margot. They had been favorites, but of course that changed when they came under the shadow of the bishop's frown. Many of their friends fell away entirely, and the rest became cool and distant. Margot was a lovely girl of 18 when the trouble came. She had the best head in the village and the most in it. She taught the harp and earned all her clothes and pocket money by her own industry. But her scholars fell off one by one now. She was forgotten when there were dances and parties among the youth of the village. The young fellows stopped coming into the house, all except Wilhelm Miedling, and he could have been spared. She and her uncle were sad and forlorn in their neglect and disgrace. Matters got worse and worse over the last 2 years. Clothes were wearing out. Bread was harder and harder to get, and now, at last, the very end had come. Solomon Isaacs had lent all the money he was willing to put on the house and gave notice that tomorrow he would foreclose. Together and had been so from the cradle, fond of each other from the beginning. Nicholas Bauman, son of the principal judge of the local court. Seppi Wallmeyer, son of the keeper of the principal inn, the Golden Stag. And I was the third, Theodore Fisher, son of the church organist, composer, sexton, and in other ways a useful citizen, respected by all. We three knew the hills and the woods as well as the birds knew them. We were always roaming them when we had leisure, at least when we were not swimming, boating, or fishing, or playing on the ice, or sliding downhill. We also had the run of Castle Park, and very few had that. It's because we were pets of the oldest serving man in the castle, Felix Brandt. And often we went there nights to hear him talk about old times and strange things, and to smoke with him, he taught us that, and to drink coffee, for he had served in the wars and was at the siege of Vienna, and there, when the Turks were defeated and driven away, among the captured things were bags of coffee. And the Turkish prisoners explained how to make a pleasant drink. Now he always kept coffee to drink himself and astonish the ignorant. When it stormed, he kept us up all night. And while it thundered and lightning outside, he told us about ghosts and horrors of every kind, of battles and murders and mutilations and such things, and made it pleasant and cozy inside. And he told these things from his own experience, largely. He had seen many ghosts in his time, and witches and enchanters, and once he was lost in a fierce storm at midnight in the mountains, and by the glare of the lightning, he had seen the wild huntsman rage on the blast with his specter dogs chasing after him through the driving cloud rock. Also, he had seen an incubus once, and several times he had seen the great bat that sucks the blood from the necks of people while they are asleep, fanning them softly with its wings, and so keeping them drowsy till they die. But the strangest thing was that he had seen angels, actual angels out of heaven, and talked with them. They had no wings and wore clothes. They talked and looked and acted just like any natural person. You would never know them for angels except for the wonderful things they did which a mortal could not do, and the way they suddenly disappeared when you were talking to them. He said they were pleasant and cheerful, not gloomy and melancholy like ghosts. It was after that kind of talk, one May night, that we got up next morning, had a good breakfast with him, then went down and crossed the bridge, and went up into a woody hilltop, which was a favorite place of ours. There we stretched out on the grass in the shade to rest and smoke and talk. But we couldn't smoke. We had left our flint and steel behind. Soon there came a youth strolling toward us through the trees. And he sat down and began to talk in a friendly way, just as if he knew us. We didn't answer him. We weren't used to strangers. He had new and good clothes on and was handsome with a winning face and pleasant voice, and was easy and graceful and unembarrassed, not slouchy and awkward and diffident like other boys. We wanted to be friendly with him, but didn't know how to begin. Then I thought of the pipe and wondered if I should offer it to him. But then I remembered we had no fire. He looked at me, bright and pleased, and said, "Fire? That's easy. I'll furnish it." I was so astounded I couldn't speak, for I had said nothing. He took the pipe and blew his breath on it. The tobacco glowed red and smoke rose up. We jumped and ran a few steps, although he was pleading for us to stay, giving his word he would do us no harm, but only wanted to have company. So we stopped and stood. We wanted to go back, full of curiosity, but afraid to venture. He went on coaxing in his soft, persuasive way, and when we saw that the pipe didn't blow up and nothing happened, our confidence returned. Little by little, our curiosity became stronger than our fears. We ventured back, but slowly, and ready to flee at any moment. He was bent on putting us at ease, and had the right art. One could not remain doubtful and timorous when a person was so earnest and simple and gentle and talked so alluringly as he did. He won us over, and it wasn't long before we were content and comfortable and chatty and glad we found this new friend. When the feeling of constraint was all gone, we asked him how he had learned to do such strange things, and he said he hadn't learned it at all. It came natural to him, like other things, curious things. "What things?" we inquired. "A number. I don't know. Many." "Will you show us more?" I spoke. "Do please," the others said. "You won't run away again," he replied. "No, indeed, we won't. Please do, won't you?" "Yes, with pleasure. But you mustn't forget your promise, you know. We said we wouldn't, and he went to a puddle and came back with water in a cup, which he made out of a leaf, and blew upon it and threw it out, and it was a lump of ice, the shape of the cup. We were astonished and charmed, but not afraid anymore. We were glad to be there, and asked him to go on and do some more things, and he did. He said he would give us any kind of fruit we liked, whether it was in season or not. We all spoke at once. Oranges, apples, grapes. They're in your pockets, he said. And it was true. They were of the best, too. We ate them and wished we had more, though none of us said so. You'll find them where those came from, he said, and everything else your appetites call for. You need not name the thing you want. As long as I'm with you, you have only to wish and to find. He spoke the truth. Breads, cakes, sweets, nuts, whatever we wanted, it was there. He ate nothing himself, but sat and chatted and did one curious thing after another to amuse us. He made birds of clay and set them free, and they flew away, singing. At last I became bold enough to ask who he was. An angel, he said, quite simply, and set another bird free. A kind of awe fell upon us when we heard him say that, and we were frightened again, but he said we need not be troubled. There was no occasion for us to be afraid of an angel, and he liked us anyway. He went on chatting as simply and unaffectedly as ever, and while he talked he met a crowd of little men and women the size of your finger, and they went diligently to work and cleared and leveled off a space a couple of yards square in the grass, and began to build a cunning little castle in it, the women mixing the mortar and carrying it up the scaffolds in pails on their heads, just as our workwomen have always done, and the men laying the courses of masonry, 500 of these little toy people swarming briskly about and working diligently and wiping the sweat off their faces as natural as life. In the absorbing interest of watching these 500 little people make the castle grow, step by step and course by course, and take shape and symmetry, that feeling and awe soon passed away. We were quite comfortable and at home again. We asked if we might make some people, and he said yes. He told Seppi to make some cannon for the walls, and told Nicholas to make some halberdiers with breastplates and greaves and helmets, and I was to make some cavalry with horses. In allotting these tasks, he called us by our names, but didn't say how he knew them. Then Seppi asked him what his own name was, and he said, tranquilly, Satan, and held out a chip and caught a little woman on it who was falling from the scaffolding and put her back where she belonged and said, she's an idiot to step backward like that.
Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name. Oh, yeah. I was puzzling you with the nature of my game. Oh, yeah.
It caught us. Suddenly, that name did, and our work dropped out of our hands and broke into pieces, a cannon, a halberdier, and a horse. Satan laughed and said, what's the matter? I said, nothing, only it seemed a strange name for an angel. He asked why. Because it's, well, it's his name, you know? It's a common angel name. He said it placidly, but it took our breath for a moment and made our hearts beat. He didn't seem to notice that, but mended our halberdiers and, handing them to us, finished. I should not be able to make anyone understand how exciting it all was. You know, the kind of quiver that trembles around when you are seeing something so strange and enchanting and wonderful that it's just a fearful joy to be alive and look at. And you know how you gaze and your lips turn dry and your breath comes short, but you wouldn't be anywhere but there. Not for the world. There was a question in my mind, and he turned to me and answered it. I am older than you count, he said. Then he turned to Nicholas and said, no, the fall did not affect me. Angels are ignorant of sin. We're not able to commit it.
I'll kick your ass, you wretched cur.
Two of the little workmen were quarreling,
oh, yeah, your mother has been
and in buzzing little bumblebee voices,
looks like a gargoyle.
They were cursing and swearing at each other. Now came blows and blood, and they locked themselves together in a life-and-death struggle. Satan reached out his hand and crushed the life out of them with his fingers, threw them away, wiped the red from his fingers on his handkerchief, and went on talking where he had left off. We can do no wrong. Neither have we any disposition for it, for we do not know what it is. It seemed a strange speech in the circumstances, but we barely noticed that. We were so shocked and grieved at the wanton murder he had committed, for murder it was. That was its true name, and it was without palliation or excuse, for the men had not wronged him in any way. It made us miserable, for we loved them, and had thought him so noble and so beautiful and gracious, and had honestly believed he was an angel. And to have him do this cruel thing, oh, it lowered him so, and we had such pride in him. He went right on talking, just as if nothing had happened, telling about his ravels and the interesting things that he had seen in the big worlds of our solar system and of other solar systems, far away in the remoteness of space, and about the customs of the immortals, and somehow fascinating us, enchanting us, charming us, in spite of the pitiful scene that was now under our eyes. For the wives of the little dead men had found the crushed and shapeless bodies and were now crying over them, and sobbing and lamenting, and a priest was kneeling there with his hands crossed upon his breast, praying, and crowds of pitying friends were massed about them, reverently uncovered, with their bare heads bowed, many with tears running down, a scene which Satan paid no attention till the small noise of the weeping and praying began to annoy him. And then he reached out and took the heavy board seat of our swing and brought it down and mashed all those people into the earth just as if they had been flies, and went on talking just the same. An angel? Kill a priest? An angel? Who did not know how to do wrong and yet destroys in cold blood hundreds of helpless poor men, women, who had never done him any harm? It made us sick to see that awful deed, and to think that none of those poor creatures was prepared except the priest, for none of them had ever heard a mass or seen a church, and we were witnesses. We had seen the murders. But he went on, talking right along and working his enchantments on us, and that fatal music of his voice, he made us forget everything. We could only listen to him and love him and be his slaves to do with us as he would. He made us drunk with the joy of being with him and looking into the heaven of his eyes and feeling the ecstasy that thrilled along our veins with the touch of his hand.
Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name. Oh, yeah. I was puzzling you with the nature of
the stranger had seen everything. He had been everywhere. He knew everything and forgot nothing. What others study, he learned at a glance. And he made things live before you when he spoke of them. He saw the world made. He saw Adam created. He saw Samson surge against the pillars and bring the temple down in ruins about him. He saw Caesar's death. He told of the daily life in heaven. He had seen the damned writhing in the red waves of hell. He made us see all these things as if we were looking at them with our own eyes. And we felt them too, but there was no sign that they were anything to him beyond mere entertainments. These visions of hells, those poor babes and women and girls and lads and men shrieking, supplicating in anguish, we could hardly bear it. But he was as bland as if they were just so many imitation rats in an artificial fire. And always, when he was talking about men and women here on earth and their doings, even their grandest and sublimest, we were ashamed, for his manners opined that their doings were of paltry, poor consequence. Often you would think he was talking about flies.
often he said in so many words that our people here were quite interesting to him, dull and ignorant and trivial and conceited and so diseased and rickety and such a shabby, poor, worthless lot all around, all without bitterness. Just as a person might talk about bricks or manure or any other thing that was of no consequence, and I could see he meant no offense, but in my thoughts, I set it down as not very good manners. Manners, he said, it's the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
The truth is good manners. Manners are a fiction. The castle is done. Do you like it? Anyone would have been obliged to like it. It was lovely to look at. It was so shapely and fine and so cunningly perfect in all its particulars, even to the little flags waving on the turrets. Satan said we must put the artillery in place now and station the halberdiers and display the cavalry. Our men and horses were a spectacle to see. They were so little like what they were intended for. Of course, we had no art in making such things. Satan said they were the worst he had seen, and when he touched them and made them alive, it was just ridiculous the way they acted. On account of their legs not being of uniform length, they reeled and sprawled about as if they were drunk and endangered everybody's lives around them, and finally fell over and lay helpless and kicking. It made us all laugh, though it was a shameful thing to see. The guns were charged with dirt, but they were so crooked and so badly made that they all burst when they went off and killed some of the gunners and crippled the others. Satan said we would have a storm now and an earthquake if we liked, but we must stand off a piece out of danger. We wanted to call the people away, too, but he said, never mind them. They're of no consequence. And we could make more sometime or other if we needed them. A storm cloud began to settle down black over the castle, and the miniature lightning and thunder began to play. The ground to quiver, and the wind to pipe and wheeze, and the rain to fall, and all the people flocked into the castle for shelter. The cloud settled down blacker and blacker, and one could see the castle only dimly through it. The lightning blazed out, flash upon flash, that pierced the castle and set it on fire. And the flames shone out red and fierce through the cloud, and the people came flying out, shrieking. But Satan brushed them back. Paying no attention to her begging, crying, and imploring in the midst of the howling of the wind and volleying of the thunder. The magazine blew up. The earthquake rent the ground wide. The castle wrecked, and the ruin tumbled into the chasm, which swallowed it from sight and closed upon it with all that innocent life. Not one of the 500 poor creatures escaping. Our hearts were broken. We could not keep from crying.
Don't cry, said Satan. They have no value.
And tune in next week for the next installment of The Mysterious Stranger, adapted for radio by the wonderful Scooter from KPFT in Houston. And thanks to Paul Reichmandel and Isaac McDonald for their contributions to this week's program. You can contact us on the web at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco. Thank you for listening.